avoid a confrontation. He walked up to a brother he didn't know, pushed his glasses back up on his nose, walked up to the man and went through the now familiar handshake. He asked where China hung out. The brother pointed toward a small hooch half hidden beneath a huge felled tree, barely 2 feet from a machine gun position. He went over and saw China and two brothers leaning against the trunk of the tree on the side away from the hooch. They were eating supper. Their voices reminded him of summer nights in Baltimore. China greeted him, going through the handshake. "Hey, brother, glad you could come by. Meet my friends." One of them offered Breuer a sea ration can filled with hot coffee. He took it and sat down, gingerly holding the folded-down lid so the heat wouldn't burn his fingers. When he started to tell them about the haircut, he was surprised at the anger that spilled out.
"And then the chicken shit motherfuckers shaved him bald. They shaved him fucking bald, and we just stood there and watched those motherfuckers."
When Breuer finished, China sprang to his feet.
"You tell Parker to get his ass over here as soon as he can, and don't worry, we won't be standing around much longer no more. We got the power."
He was pounding his fist on the log.
"We got the power. We're gonna do some fucking over our own pretty soon."
Breuer hurried away, feeling understood, feeling China's will and strength. China sat down against the log and sighed. He reached out to heat up another cup of coffee. The two others, knowing that China would speak when he had something to say, began to talk to each other, extinguishing the fire when darkness finally fell. Breuer relayed China's message to Parker, and when Parker got off watch that night, he made his way over to 2nd Platoon's area. He had to half-crawl, half-crouch up to the top of the LZ, and then head back down to 2nd Platoon to avoid being shot by accident. In the blackness, it took him about an hour. When he reached China's hooch, the brother China shared it with was asleep and alone. He angrily told Parker to go down to the hole below them. He did, and after identifying himself, he slipped into China's two-man fighting hole.
"Shh,"
China said, pretending to hear something, trying to think. The wind moved up the hill toward them, smelling of wet earth and moss. Brush, unseen, just 10 meters in front of them, whispered beneath creaking trees.
"You said you wanted to see me,"
Parker finally whispered.
"Yeah." China was still thinking. "They fuck with me this afternoon. Fuck with me bad, man." "Stupid shit, shut the fuck up,"
China whispered fiercely.
"Hey, what's with you, man?"
"What's with me?"
China whispered.
"What's with you making a jive-ass flaky scene over a fucking haircut?"
"Hey, you told me, man."
"I told you we'd wait to pick our ground and then we'd have a cause. Now I got every brother in the company wondering what the fuck I'm gonna do over a jive-ass fucking haircut. I ought to take your fucking hat off. I just get the brothers sending parts to me and you got to blow shit up."
"They fucking castrated me right in front of my brothers and you be saying I fucked up?"
Parker's lips curled back. His anger was barely under control. China felt it but knew he could handle Parker.
"Hey, brothers, cool it, huh?"
China's hooch mate was whispering from the open flap.
"Riddle'll be checking lines any time, and he light big fire to our asses if you don't cool it."
Parker cooled down slightly, and China shifted his feet.
"Look," China said, "the racist motherfucker's gonna be taught a lesson, but you gotta do it up right. You hear me? You gotta do it up right. We don't keep the power unless we keep our brains. You hear me? And the brothers back home need weapons. Real weapons."
"I hear you," Parker said sullenly. "I'll kill the motherfucker myself."
"You don't kill nobody without my say-so."
"I'll kill any fucking pig I want."
"You listen to me, Parker. We need you. You know that, right? You know that. Your brothers need you. But we don't need you doing no killing unless it's a real showdown. We don't need you doing that. You let me and Henry decide that stuff. We get it together next time we in VCB.
"Shit. We ain't seen VCB in 2 months. What makes you think we see VCB now? Henry rotate home before you see him? Shit."
"We see him, Parker. You just learned to buy time. We got time. Now you let me think how I'm going to handle this, okay? And no fucking around with it. You just let me think about this tonight and I'll start seeing the brothers in the morning, okay?"
"Okay."
"You did fine, brother. It took a lot of guts to stand up like that. I'm sorry I jumped on you. It's just we plan for really big stakes here. You hear me? Big stakes. Can't be no mistakes.
China cackled, leaving Parker nothing to say. Parker went to all fours to feel his way back to his own fighting hole, leaving China in total blackness. China spent the rest of his watch and even took his hoochmate's watch trying to figure out how to handle the situation. He had to move the emphasis from something trivial like haircuts. Cassidy seemed a likely target. Cassidy, not the fucking haircut, was the key to the situation. He'd see the brothers first thing in the morning before patrol.
China did see the brothers first thing in the morning. Mellis, worried, watched him talking. When Mellis went down to join First Squad for the patrol, Mole was conspicuously late, still cleaning his machine gun in full view of the assembled squad, picking away at minuscule pieces of lint. The heavy noose hung from his coffee-colored neck. Mole, who was 6'2" and very well built, didn't look like a mole. He'd received the nickname on the DMZ operation. Connolly's squad had been pinned down, and Mole had moved so slow to the ground behind rocks and bushes to flank the enemy that the rest of the squad swore he'd gone underground. He'd opened up on the NVA, killing two and scattering the rest. The skipper had put him up for a Bronze Star.
"You gonna burp it too, Mole?" Mellis asked, trying to make his voice light.
Mole continued cleaning the weapon.
"Gun's gotta be babied, sir," he mumbled, "especially when we can't get the fucking parts we order."
Mellis squatted down next to him.
"You pissed off about something, Mole?"
"No, sir, just doing my job."
Mole scrutinized the gun's heavy receiver. Not wanting to confront the haircut issue, Mellis looked at his watch. "Look, Mole, we're 5 minutes late already. Try and hurry it up, okay?"
Mole grunted and clamped the belt feeder assembly into place. Mellis joined Connolly in Vancouver, as well as Daniels, the artillery FO, the German Shepherd, Pat, and Corporal Aaron, Pat's handler. They were all checking their weapons, adjusting straps, stuffing favorite sea rations into pockets for lunch, and taking final drinks of water before topping off their canteens, all the nervous rituals one does to keep the ego functioning in the face of imminent death. Mellis felt a surge of pride that Vancouver was in his platoon. Although he hadn't known who Vancouver was at the time, he remembered clearly their first encounter. It had been at VCB while he was waiting for a helicopter to take him and Goodwin out to Matterhorn. It was mostly a time of cold drizzle, boredom, and nervous energy amid rifled boxes of sea rations gone soggy, and the smell of JP-4 fuel and urinal pipes stuck in sodden clay. But Mellis could have spent the rest of his days lying there in the mud. That squalid landing zone at VCB was a place where he could stay alive, where the dreaded bush lay in the future, beyond the helicopter's ramp. At VCB you could watch the helicopters leave without you. There you never had to step through the dark aluminum-ringed portal to the unknown terror of the bush. Still, by mid-afternoon, even Goodwin had been worn down by the rain and the boredom. They all dozed in the gray light, drizzle falling on them, stupefied by waiting and by their desire to forget what they were waiting for. Then the monotony broke. A single Marine jumped off the back of an incoming helicopter and walked slowly across the landing zone toward the dirt road that led to the regiment's rear area. The Marine stood 6'3 or 6'4, but his size wasn't nearly as interesting as the sawed-off M60 machine gun dangling from two web belts hung over his shoulders. An M60 usually took two men to operate. The book assigned a crew of three. A crude handle had been welded onto the barrel so the Marine could control the kick without resting it on a bipod. Two cans of machine gun ammo lay against his chest, suspended from his shoulders. In addition to all this weight, Mellis guessed that he also carried the usual full pack of the bush Marine: sleeping gear, food, extra clothes, hand grenades, books, letters, magazines, ponchos for shelter from the rain, shovel, claymore mines, bars of C4 plastic explosive, trip flares, handmade stove, pictures of girlfriends, toilet articles, insect repellent, cigarettes, rifle cleaning gear, WD-40, jars of freeze-dried coffee and maybe a package or two of long rats, freeze-dried trail food designed as rations for long-range patrols but more often used by the grunts for special occasions. On the Marine's head was an Australian bush hat, left brim folded up at the side. Matted blonde hair, discolored with grime, showed beneath it. His uniform was a mass of tattered holes and filth. One trouser leg had been torn off just below the knee, revealing pasty white flesh covered with infected leech bites and jungle rot. His hands, face, and arms were also covered with jungle rot and open sores. You could smell him as he walked by. But he walked by as if the LZ belonged to him, seemingly unaware of the 100 or more pounds he carried. He was a bush marine, and Mellis wanted fervently to be just like him. What Mellis didn't know then, but knew now, was that Vancouver had made the usual swap for the most tattered clothing in his platoon. He would be able to get all new clothing back in the rear, and that Lieutenant Fitch, acting on Fredrickson's recommendation, had sent him to VCB to clean up his NSU, nonspecific urethritis. Vancouver had contracted this medical problem when the company was at VCB some weeks before, waiting to lift out on the next operation. Instead of staying where he should have been, he had sneaked off one night through 7 kilometers of unsecured territory to a Buru village near Kalu. Rumor had it that Vancouver was secretly married to a girl there. The memory of seeing Vancouver at VCB gave Mellis a deep yearning to be back in its comparative safety. From VCB, Matterhorn had looked like the bush. Now Matterhorn itself felt like VCB. In the distant valley below Mellis were unseen trails, connecting base camps and supply dumps, crisscrossing the border into North Vietnam and Laos, a spidery network that carried the supplies and replacements for the NVA's operations against the population centers in the south and along the coast. The battalion's job was to stop them. Soon, he knew, he'd be down there. No perimeter, no artillery battery, no landing zones, no Matterhorn. The real bush. Malice's mind snapped back to the task at hand. They were going on another routine patrol to protect the artillery battery. When Mole finished cleaning his machine gun, he walked over to Connolly and nodded. Connolly broke into activity, calling out the starting order of the fire teams and the patrol. Vancouver moved quietly down toward the intricate maze that was the only way through the barbed wire. Skosh, normally Bass's radio operator, had been sitting against a stump with his eyes closed the whole time. He rose and joined Mellis behind the first team. He and Hamilton had traded jobs to help relieve boredom. The scout dog, Pat, sniffed at each Marine as he went by, memorizing his smell. Once in the jungle, Pat would be alert to any smell that was different. Aaron said Pat could memorize well over 100 individual scents. In 5 minutes, they were down the steep hill into the jungle, away from the litter, tangled wire, garbage, and barren mud. A bird called. They heard its wings as it flapped away from the squad's path. The canopy rose high above them, 100 to 150 feet, blocking out sunlight, casting the squad into shadow. Down they went, like divers in a gray-green sea. Pat was alert almost immediately, but Mellis and Corporal Aaron were both expecting one of 3 two-man outposts that sat outside the company perimeter during the day. The squad wound silently by Meeker and Merritt from 2nd Platoon, acknowledging them with silent smiles. Outpost, or OP, duty was easy, except that the OP was likely to be sacrificed, warning the company of an attack. The squad continued down the trail. The OP disappeared behind them. About 10 minutes later, Aaron went down on one knee, his hand on Pat's quivering back, trying to read Pat's message. The squad halted, and everyone tensed, looking to the sides of the trail. Aaron pointed off the trail to the right and then pointed down. Mellis raised an eyebrow to Conman, and Conman nodded. Mellis put his thumb up. Okay. And Conman tapped the kid in front of him and pointed right. The squad slipped off the trail that followed the crest of the finger and began working down a steep draw toward the valley floor. Suddenly they were engulfed in bamboo. The top of the bamboo was about 3 feet above their heads, and they had to thread their way cautiously, moving aside stalks to build their own tunnel through the solid green mass. Vancouver, on point, started going too far into the bottom of the draw. Mellis threw a pebble at Conman. Conman turned, and Mellis gave him a negative sign and pointed upslope. The word passed up front to Vancouver, and the squad quit going downhill into the draw, staying mid-slope on the finger that led down to the valley. Walking down a draw was an invitation to an ambush. The sign came for the machetes. One was passed up from behind Mellis, and soon everyone could hear the dull thwack of the blade as an impassable tangle was cut away so the squad could move again. With each sound, rifles were held tighter and eyes and ears strained a little more. Finally, the sound ceased. The squad began moving again, everyone ready to fire at the slightest noise or movement in the jungle. The squad crawled, slid, sweated, and muttered its way through the dark jungle. Machetes had to be passed forward again. Again their dull thwacking echoed down the line. Kids bit their lower lips, fingered their safeties on and off. Yet without the machetes they couldn't move, and if they couldn't move, they couldn't return to the safety of the perimeter. Conman rotated the lead fire team as each team became exhausted from the tension of being on point and the back-breaking work of swinging the machetes. Everyone, even Mellis, took his turn with a machete. Mellis knew it was foolish for him. It hindered tactical control. But he wanted to show that he could share some of the burden. He was acutely aware that the squad could be heard hundreds of meters away. Yet the patrol was going to certain checkpoints to make sure the NVA were kept well away from approach paths to Matterhorn. This literal bushwhacking let the patrol accomplish its mission without walking down established trails where the odds of getting ambushed were greatly increased. As he was finding out, no strategy was perfect. All choices were bad in some way. Within minutes, Mellis's hands were raw and blistered, and his arm felt weighted down. The whole time he was hacking at the bamboo, he felt naked, aware that his rifle was in his left hand and that his finger was not on the trigger. If he was fired on, he would have to rely on the kid behind him to take out the enemy. Finally, after an eternity, someone tapped him on the shoulder and he dropped back behind Conman, where Skosh was with the radio. Mellis was sweating profusely from both his labor and his fear. A voice within his head began mocking him, asking him why in hell any NVA would be anywhere near the middle of this damned bamboo patch they'd stumbled into. 2 more hours went by before they were out of the bamboo and back into the relative ease of walking through jungle, sweating, fighting insects, groping, as blind as the leeches against which they waged their real war. Lieutenant Fitch asked for pos reps, position reports, every 20 minutes or so. Mellis dutifully radioed them in, feeling frustrated and useless because they barely changed. In 2 hours, the patrol had gone perhaps 300 meters. Then, in an instant, the dullness and fatigue were swept away, leaving clean, cold terror. Conman dived to the dirt in front of Mellis. Skosh, too, hit the dirt before Mellis could even fold his knees. The entire squad was flat on the ground, rifles alternating sides all along the line, as they were assigned. Conman peered intently forward. Then he started to hunch and wriggle backward on his belly and forearms toward Mellis. He turned and held up 3 fingers, then held out an open palm with a questioning look on his face. At least 3, maybe more. Mellis's heart started to pound painfully in his throat. He was trying to remember what he'd been told to do, back at Quantico. His mind seemed empty. Conman squirmed back farther. Mellis could see no one else. All alone. All alone and maybe about to die.
"Pat alerted," Conman whispered. "Aaron says at least 3 kooks by the way Pat's acting. Probably more." "Maybe it's the machine gun team," Mellis whispered, thinking, "Why me?"
Conman shrugged.
"What'll we do, Lieutenant?"
Mellis didn't have the slightest idea. He wanted to radio Bass and the Jayhawk and ask them. At the same time, he knew that this idea was ridiculous. His mind was turning over possibilities so fast that he felt dizzy. Meanwhile, Conman waited, open-mouthed, for Mellis to come up with a plan of action. If it was just 3, he could send in the squad online and wipe them out. If it was a 3-man OP, an outpost for a larger unit, that unit could be anything from a platoon to a company. If he went in with the squad, they'd walk right into the deep shit and be lucky to come out with anybody alive. Then again, if it was only 3, there would be no excuse for not going after them. But someone would probably get killed. It might be Mellis, unless he sent 2 fire teams in without him. But what would the others think of that? He'd have to go. But he could get killed.
It was only three. How could he be afraid? The odds were so much in their favor. Mellis suddenly saw himself and the 14 squad members lined up against a wall, facing a firing squad of 15 men, only one of whom had a bullet in his rifle. The odds would be very much in his favor there as well. But suppose the one bullet hit him? He suddenly knew that odds became meaningless when everything was at stake. Mellis decided to assume it was an outpost for a larger group until he knew otherwise. That meant he'd have to find out. His training took over. His mind started inventorying his available weapons.
"Gun up,"
he whispered to Skosh. The word went back to invisible kids lying on the jungle floor.
"Set it in here," Mellis whispered to Conman. "Put Vancouver with his machine gun 180 from it." "He won't like it." "To hell with him. Send a fire team around to the left. We'll cover with mold if they get into the shit. Who do you want to go?"
Now it was Conman's turn to play God at age 19. He shut his eyes.
"Ryder."
So some are chosen to die young. Mellis turned to Skosh.
"Ryder up."
Skosh crawled back toward the next man.
"Ryder up,"
the whisper passed along.
"Your 79 man have any shotgun rounds?"
Mellis asked Conman. Conman held up three fingers. Mellis cursed under his breath. The rounds, so useful in the jungle where nothing could be seen, were always in short supply. The M79 men hoarded them like misers.
"You'll go with the team," Conman nodded. "Set the gun in so Ryder can get his ass back if he runs into trouble. I'll go and pick him up." "What about artillery?"
Conman asked. Mellis felt a sudden sinking in his stomach. He'd forgotten all about it.
"I'll see Daniels on the way down,"
he said, saving face. Conman gave him a thumbs up and started crawling to the nearest person to set up the perimeter. Mellis passed Skosh.
"Stick with Conman. I'll be with Daniels and on the arty frequency if the six wants me."
Mellis continued crawling down the line of intense, questioning faces. He kept whispering,
"Three gooks, maybe more. Conman'll set you in."
All the while motioning them forward. He met Mole and Young, Mole's assistant gunner, moving forward, both of them sweating heavily. Mole looked grim. Young gave a wan smile, dragging the heavy machine gun ammunition beside him on the ground, trying very hard to move without making noise.
"You'll block for Ryder,"
Mellis whispered to Mole.
"See Conman."
Mole nodded, continuing in a low crawl, the large gun cradled across his arms as he worked his way forward. Ryder came crawling forward behind Mole and Young, his face glistening, his eyes slightly wild. The two frightened kids in his fire team crawled behind him, yet no one questioned that they would do what they were told.
"Three gooks,"
Mellis whispered.
"We have to find out if that's all. Could be an OP. Tell Connolly that I said for you to take Gambaccini and his M79 with you."
Ryder licked his lips and looked quickly at his two friends. One nodded. The other was staring into the jungle as if the intensity of his gaze could reveal its secret. But the undergrowth revealed nothing. The secret could be revealed only by crawling into the jungle and meeting it there. Ryder nodded and pointed uphill, looking at his team. The three of them crawled toward the head of the column, disappearing almost immediately. Mellis continued down the line, sending kids forward to form the perimeter. Daniels crawled up, his radio slipping awkwardly from side to side on his back.
"The angle is the shits for Gulf Battery,"
Daniels whispered.
"The ridge is between them and the gooners. The 105s will have to shoot nearly straight up to come straight down on them, and Gulf is so far away the rounds won't reach. If they shoot a flatter trajectory to make the distance, they'll hit the ridge's front side or fly right over the target. I think you ought to use the company's 60s. The rounds are a tenth the weight, but they'll hit the target. I've got them on the net now."
Mellis nodded his head, thankful for Daniel's foresight.
"Good,"
he said. Daniel started forward again, twisting the frequency knob at the same time to tell his battery to stand by, that he'd be using the mortars. Then he switched frequencies again and started talking to the company mortar squad.
Mellis and Daniels met Vancouver lying in front of them, his own machine gun cradled on a rotten limb. Skosh was crawling toward Mellis, holding out the handset. Mellis grabbed it, waiting for Daniels to finish with the mortars. He noticed that Ryder's fire team and Gambaccini and his M79 grenade launcher were already gone.
"It's the skipper,"
Skosh whispered.
"I'll need a posh wrap," Fitch said. "Over. We haven't moved squat since the last one,"
Mellis whispered.
"Over. Bravo One, I want a posh wrap, you copy? Wait one."
Mellis's hands were shaking as he dug out his map. The jungle made it impossible to see any landmarks. He tried to remember the terrain they'd walked over, estimate the distances. It was like navigating underwater. He stabbed a finger at the most likely spot, still feeling it was the same place he'd radioed in last time. He looked at Daniels, raising his eyebrows. Daniels moved his finger to a point on his own map with his own peculiar pencil marks and dog ears, not trusting anyone else's. He looked at where Mellis was pointing on his own map. Thumbs up. Mellis radioed in the position. If he was wrong, the shells could hit Ryder's team, or them, instead of the enemy. Fitch got off the hook and let Corporal Devon, the squad leader of the 60-millimeter mortars, come back up on the net. Daniel started talking.
"Bravo Whiskey, Bravo 1-1, fire mission, over."
Aunt Mellis had nothing to do. He sat down while Daniels called in the mission. He noticed that there were ants on the ground where they had set in. He could barely see the backs of some of the kids as they lay beneath the foliage. A bird chirped. He didn't know if the whole thing wasn't just a foolish exercise. The thunk of mortar shells leaving the tube jarred him. For all the hours they'd walked, he was surprised to hear the sounds of tubing so close to him. There was a sudden rush and a loud crash as the 60-millimeter shells came nearly straight down. The sounds were muffled and seemed far away. Mellis wondered if they'd read the map that badly.
"Right 50, drop 100,
Daniels whispered, correcting by sound alone. The second salvo came down right on the ridge above them. The sounds were magnified tenfold, no longer masked by the earth. Daniels called for four salvos. Then he adjusted to the right and called in four more. Mellis was amazed. It was all mechanical, yet people were probably getting killed. Pat was lying quietly next to Aaron, who was sitting against a log. The dog was panting and so seemed to be grinning. His odd reddish ears were standing up. The radio whispered. Skosh handed Mellis the handset.
"I have to know the word on the basketball team."
It was Fitch, using the radio code for a fire team.
"Big John 6 wants to know. Also, Golf 6 wants to know why he's standing by and not firing the mission. Over. Tell him Character Delta thinks the angle is bad. We're masked by a ridge, and the mortars have a better shot at it. And I can't walk out and ask the damn basketball team what the score is, because I don't exactly know where they are. Which is another reason why we don't want the artillery right now. Over."
Fitch came back up laughing.
"Okay, let me know ASAP. 6 out."
An ant bit Mellis, who suppressed a yelp. He noticed Pat pressing his paws on the ground, holding his head back as if to push the ants away. Several of the kids were squirting insect repellent on their faces and legs. He looked at his wristwatch. Only 5 minutes had passed. More mortar shells crumped into the jungle. The explosions moved the ground beneath them, yet seemed somehow far away. Mellis slapped at a fly and missed. It circled off and landed on Skosh, who did exactly the same thing. 2 more minutes went by. Daniels told the mortars to hold off for a minute. One of the kids was cautiously moving his leg back and forth, probably trying to get the blood back into a foot that had fallen asleep. The fly landed on Mellis again. Then the jungle ripped apart. It was as if someone had torn a sheet of solid sound. The M-16s, on full automatic, screamed, making Mellis wince and shut his eyes. Just a few meters in front of him, he could hear the slower, more solid hammering of the heavier caliber NVA AK-47s. Mellis, who had buried his face in the earth, now raised his eyes, trying to see through the jungle to where the sound originated. Quick bursts from the lighter, higher-velocity M-16s of Ryder's fireteam were going off. The bursts alternated as one rifleman would cover for another who was slamming in a new magazine. The blurred screams of the M-16s on full automatic answered the slower and heavier slapping of the AK-47s. The AK bullets cracked overhead, cutting branches in two. Leaves, bark, and splinters rained down on the men's helmets and backs. There was a short, explosive pop, followed almost immediately by the thud of a much louder explosion as Gambaccini got off a grenade round. Uphill from them, someone was shouting. There were crashing sounds in the jungle. The radio was screaming, "What the fuck's going on? You're being hit! Over!" Melis could scarcely talk because of the blood pounding in his throat. The air was crazy with the ear-hammering noise of automatic weapons.
"That's a neg!"
Melis was unaware that he was shouting.
"It's the basketball team! Over!" "Where are they? Give me a pause rep! Over!"
Fitch's voice steadied Melis, who had to cover one ear with his hand to hear what Fitch was saying.
"About 25 meters bearing 045, maybe less. I don't know. I can't see shit."
Melis's words were coming out in gasps.
"Get your arty cranked up. You want the 60s dropped in closer? Over." "That's an egg!"
Melis gasped for air.
"Don't know where the team is."
Panting.
"Character Delta's going up on the arty net now. Over."
Melis was bewildered by the suddenness of it all. It had been so methodical, so easy. Now he couldn't even tell where the fire was coming from. Should he go after Ryder or wait for him? Questions rattled through his head, but no answers came. He decided to stay put. An AK-47 bullet with just enough energy left to keep moving after it exited from a thick brush stem fluttered over Melis's head with a high-pitched whine and lost itself in the dense jungle behind him. Then there was silence. It was as if the last shattering burst had killed all sound. Everyone was breathing rapidly. Mole was digging his toes into the earth behind the machine gun, the stock pulled in tight to his shoulder, staring down the barrel as if trying to cut through the jungle with his eyes. There were no sounds from the forest. Melis crawled up next to Connolly and whispered,
"We've got to get in touch with Ryder."
Connolly nodded. He cupped his hands and called out in a strangled half-whisper,
"Ryder!"
His voice carried through the silence like a shaft of light through a dark cave. No answer. An insect started to cheer up again.
"Ryder, get your ass back in here. Call my name when you get closer. We'll know it's you."
Connolly turned to Melis.
"He ain't hardly going to yell back, sir."
The radio hissed with static. Melis knew what was coming. "This is Bravo 6. We need a sit rep. Big John is creaming his jeans. Over."
"6, this is 1 actual. No change yet. Over."
There was a long pause. Fitch knew as well as anyone that, at the moment, to go looking for Ryder would be insane. He'd be shooting anything that moved. So would any number of NVA. The radio hissed again.
"I copy, but you've got to get me a sit rep ASAP. Over." "I copy. We're working on it. Over." "Roger that. Bravo 6 out."
3 long minutes went by. Then they heard a sound in the bushes. Rifles moved in unison, focusing on the single sound. Connolly's hand was up, holding the fire. A whisper cut through the bush.
"Conman."
Rifles relaxed.
"Here,"
Conman whispered back. A brief commotion followed. Then Ryder came scrambling into the perimeter, crouched low, followed by his 2 team members and Gambaccini with the M79 still smoking from the barrel. They threw themselves to the ground. Ryder crawled over to Melis. He was breathing hard. His face was streaked with dirt and sweat. His utility shirt reeked.
2 gooks,
he said.
"Maybe more. We saw each other at the same time."
His chest heaved, trying to pull in more air.
"We both opened up. We hit the deck. Shot shit out of everything. I may have hit one. They DD'd." "Which way?"
Ryder shook his head negatively.
"Fuck if I know. Downhill." "That'd be south,"
Melis said, pulling out his map. He pulled the squad back while Daniels worked over the area south and east of them with artillery and mortar fire, controlling the 105mm from his own radio and the 60mm from Scotia's radio. After about 15 minutes, the squad moved into the worked-over area, everyone on the alert, Pat quivering with excitement but under perfect control by Aaron. Pat picked up a trail and started tracking. The squad followed Pat down into the valley. They worked through thicker and thicker growth, occasionally seeing a torn bush, a broken tree limb, or fresh dirt from the artillery. Other than these small signs and the smell of the explosive, the half-hour fire mission and fight had made no impression on the jungle at all. The Marines began to grow weary. The radio cracked.
Bravo 1, this is Bravo 6. Big John wants an after-action report. He can't wait any longer. He's got to see Bushwhacker 6. I've also got Golf 6 on my back wanting to know how his artillery did. Over. Wait 1,
Mello said. He sighed, holding the handset in front of his mouth, thinking. Mellis wanted to believe something had happened, something good that he could report. They'd shot up a quarter of an hour's worth of shells. Ryder had done an incredible job checking out the alert. No one had been hurt. It was a good job. Mellis wanted to believe they'd done well. He wanted to, so he did.
Bravo 6, this is Bravo 1. Our character Romeo feels certain he got one right when he opened up. He only saw 2 gooks, but from the sound of things, there had to be more than that. We got a probable for sure. Over.
There was a pause.
What about the artillery damage assessment? Over.
Mellis looked at Skosh. Skosh shook his head and spat, still leaning over.
I don't know. I'm just the fucking radio man.
Conman spoke up.
Give them a fucking probable and get the audio off Skipper's back. They'll never leave us alone if we don't, sir. I can't give them a goddamn probable,
Mellis said.
What evidence have I got? They don't need fucking evidence. They need an artillery damage assessment. Tell them there's all sorts of blood trails around here. They always like that.
Mellis looked at Daniels. Daniels held up both hands, palms out, and shrugged. He didn't give a shit. Mellis keyed the radio.
Bravo 6, this is Bravo 1 actual. We got one probable. That's all. Over.
He wasn't going to lie so that an artillery officer could feel good. So the one probable became a fact. Fitch radioed it in to battalion. Major Blakely, the battalion operations officer, claimed it for the battalion as a confirmed, because Ryder said he'd seen the guy he shot go down. The commander of the artillery battery, however, claimed it for his unit. The records had to show 2 dead NVA, so they did. But at regiment it looked odd. 2 kills with no probables. So a probable got added. It was a conservative estimate. It only made sense that if you killed 2, with the way the NVA pulled out bodies, you had to have some probables. It made the same sense to the commander of the artillery battalion. 4 confirmed, 2 probables, which is what the staff would report to Colonel Mulvaney, the commanding officer of 24th Marines, at the regimental briefing. By the time it reached Saigon, however, the 2 probables had been made confirms, but it didn't make sense to have 6 confirmed kills without probables, so 4 of those got added. Now it looked right. 10 dead NVA and no one hurt on our side. A pretty good day's work.
Chapter 4 Colonel Mulvaney, the regimental commander, ponderously made his way up the single aisle between the captains, majors, and lieutenant colonels who stood at attention waiting for him to reach his empty place at the front of the rows of folding chairs. The humid air in the tent smelled of mothballs. When he reached his chair, Mulvaney grunted to Major Adams, who crisply asked the men to take their seats. Mulvaney picked up the briefing sheets that had been placed on his chair and shuffled through them. His mind was on the recent discussion with the division chief of staff about the coming combined cordon and search operation at Kam Lo. It must use Arvin troops and the local militia. It would be highly conspicuous and highly political, and, in Mulvaney's view, highly impractical. He'd been asked to give 2 battalions. After his vehement argument against it, including a colorful analysis of the effectiveness of Arvin, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, he'd been ordered to give 2 battalions. Major Adams cleared his throat. Mulvaney sighed, eased his large body back into the chair, and nodded at Adams, who immediately turned to a large map and indicated with a pointer.
Contact occurred today at 11:47 hours at grid coordinates 689558 between a squad-size unit from Bravo Company 124 on a routine security patrol and an estimated 10 to 15 Vietnamese. Two confirmed kills, one probable. No injuries reported from Bravo Company. Artillery fire was called in with two confirmed kills and one probable reported. The weather prohibited air strikes.
The major turned to face Mulvaney. Mulvaney knew he should ask a question. It annoyed him that Adams kept saying 124 all the time, as if after 26 years in the Marine Corps he wouldn't know that Bravo Company of his own regiment was in the 1st Battalion. He nevertheless kept his temper, remembering his wife, Maisie, who even at the airport had cautioned him again to keep his temper, not only for the sake of the men under him, but also for the sake of his career. A fucking combined operation with the South gooks. Sitting around a goddamned village while their goon squads went in and roughed up the civilian political opposition. Again, he remembered that people were expecting a question.
Any intelligence gathered? He asked. Weapons recovered?
Major Adams hadn't covered that question. He quickly looked down at the second row of seats where Lieutenant Colonel Simpson and Major Blakely, 1st Battalion's commanding officer and operations officer, were leaning forward in their chairs behind Mulvaney. Blakely, immediately recognizing that Adams wasn't prepared for Mulvaney's question, quickly shook his head no, his lips pursed tightly. Adams, with hardly a pause, answered the colonel's question.
"That's a negative, sir. Immediately after contact was made, the friendly unit withdrew to bring in artillery fires."
Mulvaney grunted again. Even though it had been a quarter of a century ago, it seemed to him that only last weekend he himself had been leading patrols in the jungle. If he'd been leading the goddamn patrol and had run into a unit of unknown size, he could very well imagine getting his ass out of the area and not bothering to collect papers. Two kills for Bravo Company and two more for Golf Battery, with no casualties, was good enough for one day's action. It entered his mind that with a body count of four, it might be more than good enough. But he decided not to ask any questions that might put Simpson in a bad light, or himself, for that matter, for not trusting his officers. He watched Simpson writing in a notebook, his face even redder than usual, and wondered if Simpson was still drinking. When he'd been in 1st Division at Camp Pendleton, after Korea, Simpson had been drinking quite heavily. But then who didn't after that damned war? They'd returned home as if they'd been on some goddamned exercise. Blakely, he didn't know. Good-looking guy. Kind you'd see at an embassy. Too young for Korea, so no combat experience. Not his fault. Still, he wished Blakely did have experience. But his record looked good. Good fitness reports. Probably champing at the bit for a battalion. Keep an eye on him. He saw Blakely whisper something to Simpson, and Simpson again wrote in the notebook. The intelligence briefing droned on. Sensor readings picked up at coordinates 723621. An AO, air observer, spotted two NVA in the open at coordinates 781632. Elements of Hotel Company 224 uncovered two rice caches of 50 kilos each at coordinates 973560. Mulvaney's thoughts drifted. Why in hell is it always elements and not men? Who should he pick for the combined operation? He became aware of a silence and knew it was time for him to ask another question or two. After intelligence came the regimental three on operations, then the medical officer, then supply, then the adjutant, then artillery, then air, then Red Cross liaison from Quang Tri, then the congressional inquiries, and finally the commanders of the battalions. Mulvaney watched closely as Simpson strode quickly to the front of the tent. A small man, his jungle camouflage neatly starched, his red face and hands contrasting oddly with the green material. Mulvaney knew that Simpson had been a young lieutenant in Korea at the same time he himself had been there, although they hadn't known each other then. Simpson had apparently done a fine job, earning a Silver Star and a Purple Heart, and his fitness reports were all excellent. But the scuttlebutt was that there'd been a painful divorce along with the drinking problem. But then, hell, divorces and drinking weren't exactly uncommon problems in the Marine Corps. Mulvaney watched Simpson pick up Adams's pointer and turn to face him, waiting for a nod. Mulvaney could see that, as usual, Simpson was nervous as hell. You could tell right away when Simpson didn't know what he was talking about. Simpson turned to the map and began speaking. After showing the dispositions of the companies, he paused a moment for effect.
"As you can see, sir, with my company spread in an arc, here, here, and here."
The pointer whapped the map crisply at each here, fixing in place 175 to 200 Marines at each whap.
"And with Bravo Company providing security for Golf Battery here on Matterhorn, whap. I have decided it expedient that I move my tactical headquarters immediately to Matterhorn to personally direct operations, with Bravo Company making contact here, whap, and Alpha Company here, whap. I'm certain we have a sizable NVA unit operating in this area. The supply and ammunition cache found 3 days ago by Charlie Company here, whap, as well as the bunker complex that Alpha uncovered last week here, whap, all indicate that this area will soon be highly productive. I intend to be right on the spot when the shit hits the fan. That's why I've already ordered my staff to begin planning for moving my headquarters to Matterhorn."
Mulvaney looked blankly at Simpson. Just when he was thinking of using Simpson in the combined operation down in the flatlands, the son of a bitch had decided to get gungy and move to the fucking bush. As if being out in the goddamn jungle and not being able to see his men was any better than being at VCB and not being able to see his men. Yet Mulvaney couldn't talk about the operation yet. It would keep his commanders on pins and needles, wondering who was going to have to pull up stakes and head for the flats, while the South gooks fiddle-farted around with their wasted goddamn villages, and his old friend and now commander of the division, General Neitzel, could tell the Army three-star in charge of I Corps, who could report to Abrams in Saigon, that the Marines had cooperated fully with the government of the Republic of Vietnam. Several people coughed. Simpson seemed unsure what to do and looked back at Blakely for a sign. Blakely brought his eyebrows together and nodded slightly, assuring him that it was okay just to wait.
"That's fine, Simpson, fine," Mulvaney said.
Bravo Company. He searched his memory. Bravo Company. Wasn't Bravo commanded by a young first lieutenant? Fitch, wasn't it? He'd been the one who'd found an ammo dump and all those 122-millimeter rockets on the Laotian border by Khao Rock. Now Mulvaney remembered. He, Neitzel, and some of the bigger army brass had flown out there to get in a couple of pictures, and Simpson had been hovering around the edge of the group, being ignored while the brass were falling all over themselves, patting Fitch on the back. Maybe Simpson just couldn't stand not being in the limelight. Mulvaney could easily move Simpson back if he needed to. That young Fitch was lucky. Luck was one of the attributes Napoleon considered necessary for a good officer. Napoleon knew his shit. That had been the second time Fitch's picture was in Stars and Stripes. The first time was just after he'd taken over the company from Black, when Black lost his leg. The kid had fought the company out of a real shit sandwich up on the DMZ. Jesus, that was a bum deal, Black losing his leg. A good career officer. Fitch was a reservist, if Mulvaney remembered right. Christ, they're almost all reservists now. The regulars were all being chewed up by this thing over here. Still, the kid was lucky. So far. As for Simpson's sudden hots to get out into the bush, it never hurt to reward initiative, even if initiative came at an inopportune time. And Simpson could be right. That arc of recent firefights. Maybe he could compromise, pull back only two of Simpson's companies. Who knew or cared if Simpson was going to be up there to control his men better or just get into the limelight? In war, action mattered, not motives.
"Just don't get your ass shot by any gook machine guns when you fly in, Simpson."
Mellis found Hawk making coffee in his battered cup on a stove devised from a number 10 can. He was using heat tabs, which even at a distance made Mellis's nasal passages sting. "I'd like to put Ryder and his team in for some sort of medals," Mellis said. "They did a hell of a job today." Hawk didn't answer right away. He was watching the small bubbles forming at the bottom of the cup and wiping up the slight tears caused by the heat tab. This isn't the Air Force, Mellis. No shit it isn't. We did a hell of a job out there today. As soon as he said it, Mellis knew he'd slipped. He felt his face starting to redden. I didn't mean...
The fuck you didn't mean?
Hawk looked up quickly at Mellis, eyes flashing for a moment. He resumed watching the can. Mellis knew that Hawk was letting him squirm. Then, without looking up, Hawk said,
Look, Mellis, in the Navy or Air Force, they give you a medal for what the Marines consider just doing their job. In the Marines, you only get a medal for being braver than just doing your job.
Then he looked at Mellis.
You get in fixes where medals are handed out because you were unlucky and had to fix things, or because you were stupid and had to fix things. Be careful about what you're wishing for.
I don't want to get on your bad side, Mellis said. I was just...
Stow it, huh?
Hawk turned to Mellis. In a very even voice, he said, Mellis, I don't give a fuck which side of me you're on. I just want to find out whether you're going to kill any of my friends or not, and right now I'm not too fucking sure.
The hissing of the heat tab in the stove seemed very loud. Mellis was the first to break.
Okay, I wanted a medal. That doesn't mean Ryder and Conman shouldn't have one.
Hawk eased a little in response to this honesty.
Well, you don't lack for persistence.
He sighed. Look, everyone wants a medal. That's no sin. When I first got here, I wanted one, too. It's just that after you've been out here long enough to see what they cost, they don't seem so fucking shiny.
He looked up briefly to see if Mellis got the point. Then he poured two packages of instant coffee and two packages of sugar into the boiling water. He stirred it with a stick.
Sorry, Mellis said.
Hawk visibly softened. He handed up the steaming cup and smiled.
Shit, Mellis, drink this. It cures all ills, even vainglory and ambition. The only thing that hurts about a rebuke is the truth.
Mellis took the coffee and smiled. Benjamin Franklin.
Fuck no, my Uncle Art, the poet.
Benjamin Franklin. Art copped a lick.
Yeah, typical. You can never tell with Uncle Arthur. We're not even certain Grandma had him with Grandpa.
The two were silent while Mellis took a sip.
Maybe we can get Ryder a meritorious promotion to Lance Corporal,
Hawk said.
That will at least get him some more money. Of course, you'll have to write it up like it was fucking Chapultepec and Bellow Wood combined and Ryder's a potential chesty puller.
How long should it be?
Do I look like a fucking English teacher?
Can I ask you a serious question?
Why are you so fucking serious?
Hawk asked.
I'm not all the time. Neither am I.
The two of them stood there, looking at each other, suddenly seeing through their formal relationship.
Goodwin said you went to Harvard, Hawk said.
I went to Princeton.
They're all the fucking same. Same guys with tassels on their fucking loafers, same communist fucking courses.
He passed the coffee back to Mellis. Mellis took two sips, trying not to burn his lips on the hot metal. He handed the cup back to Hawk.
Where did you go to college? Mellis asked, feeling uncertain of how to proceed.
Hawk took a careful sip and licked his upper lip.
Sea to the Fourth?
Huh?
Cape Cod Community College. I finished my last 2 years at UMass.
Mellis nodded, squatting on his haunches, unconsciously imitating all the other Bush Marines who did this to avoid getting their trouser seat wet.
What the fuck you doing in the crotch anyway?
Hawk asked.
All you fucking Ivy Leaguers got enough money to get out. Doctors, psychiatrists, graduate schools, homosexual tendencies, Jesus!
He looked at Mellis suspiciously.
Are you and Goodwin shitting me about where you went to school?
Mellis paused for his usual careful weighing of answers.
I joined when I was 18, before I went to college. I grew up in a little logging town in Oregon, and any guy worth a shit does his time in the service. That's what everyone called it, the service. There wasn't any war then, and I got to go to college on a scholarship and got paid in the summers. They made me a Lance Corporal in the reserves, and I didn't have to do Navy ROTC.
You still could have gotten out when the war started. Your kind must have all sorts of fucking pull with draft boards and congressmen.
Not really.
Bullshit.
Mellis hesitated. Most of his friends from Princeton did indeed have the kind of pull Hawk was talking about. He and his friends from Neawana Union High School did not. He wanted to tell Hawk that going to Princeton was different from having a father who went to Princeton, but he didn't.
I don't know. It just seemed that all the other guys were going.
And the president doesn't lie. He must know something we don't.
Right, Mellis said.
You still could have switched to the Navy. All the rest of your hoity-toity buddies joined the Navy, didn't they? At least the ones that weren't screwing their brains out and smoking dope at some peace rally.
Yeah, mostly. The ones who joined anything. A couple joined the CIA, he added, feeling somewhat defensive about his friends.
Hawk handed Mellis the steaming pear can. Mellis, smiling at the ribbing he was getting, juggled the can from hand to hand.
Maybe I'm just a fool for wanting to be different. There are so many guys trying to get into Navy OCS. The Navy will have fucking ensigns scraping paint pretty soon.
Yeah, real happy ensigns.
Mellis laughed, took another sip, and then handed the cup back to Hawk. Hawk took a sip of coffee and eyed Mellis shrewdly over the brim of the tin can cup.
You know, I bet you're thinking you're going to run for fucking Congress as an ex-Marine.
At the Actuals meeting that night, Fitch told everyone about the plan to move the battalion headquarters group to Matterhorn as soon as possible. Bravo Company's part of the plan was nailing the NVA machine gun. Goodwin spoke voluntarily for the first time.
Hey, Jack, I got this hunch I want to try out tomorrow.
Have at it, Fitch said. He handed Goodwin his map.
This fucking gook machine gun team, Goodwin said. Both times they fire from the east side, right? And when Mellis runs into them, they DD south. But south is downhill and nothing but bamboo and elephant grass. North is cliffs and shit. That means they work around the south side of the hill and are over there.
Goodwin pointed west.
Between us and Laos, but not too far because they'd lose too much altitude. They ain't no dumber than we are, and I sure as shit wouldn't want to hump a machine gun up this fucking mountain every day just to get a chance to shoot at a chopper. But I wouldn't be so high I had to hump for water either.
Mellis envied Goodwin's practical logic.
Okay, Goodwin, Fitch said. Turn in your route and we'll prep it for you just before you go.
No prep, Jack.
You're sure?
I don't want no tip-offs. I'm going right where they are, Jack.
Goodwin pulled Fitch's map over a little. He squinted at it, then his large finger pointed to a small offshoot of a larger ridge.
Right here.
Everyone looked at the spot. Mellis looked questioningly at Hawk. Hawk shrugged. Goodwin left before dawn with one of his three squads, heading west towards Laos. Mellis went south with Jacobs and second squad from his platoon, down a long finger that led onto the valley floor below them. They were moving slowly in thick jungle along the crest of the finger when they heard the firefight start. Even though they were a good 2 kilometers south of Goodwin, the noise of the M-16s was so loud that everyone hit the dirt. Mellis grabbed the hook from Hamilton and listened.
God damn it, I don't know how many there are, Jack. I'm busy.
Bravo 2. Bravo 2, this is Bravo 6. Big John's got to have your position report. Over.
Nobody answered. Suddenly, there was complete silence.
Bravo 2, you get back on this fucking net. Over.
Firing erupted again, and the sound rolling over them was now intermingled with the thump of hand grenades. Mellis pulled out his compass and took a bearing on the sound. It was an endless, ear-shattering explosion that set his heart racing. Mellis keyed the handset.
Bravo 6, this is one actual. I've got a bearing on the sound of 340. My pause is 671519. Over.
Mellis and Fitch both knew that Mellis had just risked exposing his own unit to NVA mortar or artillery fire by revealing his position over the radio in order to give Fitch the second compass bearing that would pinpoint Goodwin's location. Fitch's voice returned.
I copy 340.
There was a brief pause.
He's just where he said they'd be. You know the spot? Over. I'm on my way.
Mellis suddenly felt useful, important, rushing to help his friend. The rush soon turned to frustration as the Marines cursed and hacked at the indifferent jungle. Mellis pushed them, swinging the machete himself when his turn came. The firing died down. Then it stopped altogether.
They linked up about an hour later. Both squads were exhausted, but Goodwin's squad was carrying one SKS rifle, an AK-47, and a long-barreled Russian DSHKM 51 caliber machine gun, plus several steel boxes of linked cartridges and a heavy, spider-legged tripod. They also had the usual belt buckles, water pipes, helmets, and military insignia and buttons, useful for trading. One of the kids had been hit seriously enough to have to hobble between two friends, but he wasn't in any real danger. Goodwin himself had been creased across the right ear with a bullet. It had taken out a small piece of flesh and cartilage and left a thin, bloody track down his neck.
"Hey, Jack!"
he boomed out to Mellis, pulling on his ear. His voice was unnaturally loud because of the temporary hearing loss. He was tugging on his bloody earlobe.
"Look at this! A fucking Purple Heart!"
He laughed with delight and adrenaline.
"Two more and I'm out of this fucking hole!"
Mellis forced a smile. It was well known that after three wounds, the Marine Corps considered the recipient too nervous, too unlucky, or too stupid to remain effective in combat. The kids in both squads laughed. Those from 2nd Platoon couldn't stop talking about how Goodwin had taken the small machine gun team by surprise, crawling up on their position, firing, throwing grenades over their crude log barrier. They'd killed three. The rest had fled. By the time they reached the perimeter, all the kids were calling Goodwin Scar. Mellis was aware of how plain and ordinary, perhaps even hesitant, he must look next to Goodwin. He couldn't quite use the word chicken shit, but deep down inside, unnamed, the fear of it was there. The next day, the battalion staff flew into Matterhorn. Lieutenant Hawk stood outside Fitch's hooch, his hands in the pockets of his field jacket. He felt invaded. Bravo had walked to Matterhorn through virgin jungle and had pushed the jungle back to form a crown of open space around Matterhorn's crest, all under the constant harassment of the machine gun team. Now the battalion CP group was flying in on choppers, trundling in bag after bag of gear, canned goods, radios, alcohol, and magazines. Hawk wanted to believe it was coincidental that they came the day after Goodwin had bagged the gook machine gun. The enlisted men, mostly radio operators and supply clerks, were digging out large bunkers and filling sandbags. Hawk knew that they were all just doing what they were told, but he resented them. Even more, he resented the way Fitch had combed his hair and shaved a second time that day to meet the colonel and the three, Blakely. "Shit," he said out loud and crawled back inside the hooch to find a cigar. Relznick and Palak were both there, playing gin and monitoring the radios. "Anything new on our Red Dogs?" Hawk asked, automatically shifting his frame of reference to the map in his head, where he constantly knew the positions of the company's security patrols.
"Nah," Palak answered, "except fucking Lieutenant Kendall turned in a pause rep that was about a click off the one Daniels turned in just after him, so I put him where Daniels said."
He turned back to his hand. This wasn't the first time that Kendall had made a mistake reading a map, and Hawk knew as well as Palak that Daniels was probably right. He also knew that Daniels had probably turned in the position report to show Kendall up. He decided not to pursue the discrepancy on the radio. He'd talk to Kendall and Daniels about it separately. He crawled back outside into the gray afternoon and lit his second-to-last cigar. He took a long, slow puff, savoring every sensation, especially the warm dryness of the smoke. "Shit," he said again, thinking of the constant rain. Then it occurred to him that with the battalion moving in, there ought to be someone up there he could buy cigars from. He smiled, his eyes roving over the lines, taking in the terrain and thinking about the positions of the patrols at the same time. Fitch had previous patrols, not current ones, on his mind. As he made his way slowly up the slope, he was rehearsing his arguments about why it took so long to get the gook machine gun. He lifted his stateside utility cover from his head, pushed down his hair, and replaced the cover neatly. When he saw Simpson and Blakely conferring over a map and occasionally looking down into the valley, he gave a short sigh and walked across the LZ to join them.
"You wanted to see me, sir?"
he asked, saluting both of them.
"No salutes, Lieutenant,"
Simpson said jauntily.
We don't want Blakely here picked off by another gook machine gun, do we?
Fitch lowered his hand and Blakely laughed.
It's good to be out in the bush, Simpson said almost absently.
He put his field glasses to his eyes and scanned the valley.
You doing okay, Tiger? Blakely asked.
Yes, sir, Fitch said. Finally, the field glasses came down and Simpson turned toward him.
You know what to do when you kill gooks, Lieutenant?
Fitch was at a loss for an answer.
Sir?
Enunciating each word as if speaking to a child, Simpson repeated,
What do you do when you kill gooks, Lieutenant?
Sir?
You don't know, do you?
No, sir. I mean, I'm not sure what the colonel is asking.
I'm asking about fucking intelligence, Lieutenant. Fucking intelligence. You know what that is?
Yes, sir. I do, sir.
Well, it doesn't look like it.
Simpson turned to Blakely as if sharing a secret. Blakely nodded and Simpson went on.
Let me help you out. You know, you don't always have Marine Corps photographers to record your after-action reports for you.
He smiled, but apparently not with good humor. Blakely did the same. Fitch smiled back uncertainly.
Intelligence, Lieutenant, Simpson went on, is built up by the fastidious collection of minutiae. You understand that, don't you? It isn't the result of spectacular finds. It's the result of hard work, constant attention to detail, to minutiae. Minutiae.
Yes, sir.
When you get dead gooks, you collect everything. Wallets, shoulder patches, letters, everything. You empty their pockets. You bring in their weapons, their backpacks. You smell their fucking breath to see what they've been eating for lunch. You follow me, Lieutenant?
Yes, sir.
Good.
I don't want any more intelligence lapses.
Yes, sir. I'm glad to see you finally got that fucking gook machine gun team. How many patrols are you running a day?
Three, sir.
Not enough, was it? 2 fucking weeks.
Sir, we were trying to put in a fire base and build up the lines at the same time.
Everyone has problems, Skipper.
Sir, we did get the machine gun and didn't lose anyone doing it. We also brought it in along with an AK and an SKS.
And what unit were they from?
Fitch licked his lip. I don't know, sir, he finally answered. He knew that since the battalion had turned in Malice's one probable as a confirmed, there would be no sense telling Simpson there was no body to search. On the other hand, Goodwin had definitely killed 3, but he'd come back in with weapons and trading material, crowing like a rooster, the kids calling him Scar. And no intelligence. Fitch almost smiled at the memory, in spite of the fact that he was getting dressed down for it now. Fuck, he thought. They're all from the 312th fucking Steel Division anyway, and everyone knows it, including you, Simpson.
You see, Lieutenant, you not only failed to be aggressive in your patrolling, you neglected your defenses.
Sir?
Your lines, Lieutenant, your lines. They're totally exposed to artillery attack.
Sir, the closest gook artillery is at Koh Rock, as far as we know. That's even farther than our own was at Iger.
You're the one who found all the fucking 122s?
I know, sir, but the gooks don't usually waste those on small infantry positions.
They're for taking out bigger stuff. You read Jop's mind now.
No, sir, I wasn't trying to say... I mean, I know nothing is for sure, but...
Exactly! Nothing is for sure. It takes you fucking forever to find that machine gun that has Bushwhacker 6 all over my ass. And I get out here and your fucking lines are a shambles and totally exposed to an artillery attack.
Sir, are you saying we should put covers on the fighting holes?
Well, Blakely,
Simpson said, turning to his 3 and smiling,
it appears the basic school still teaches standard infantry defense tactics.
Yes, sir, Blakely said. Simpson turned back to Fitch.
That's right, Lieutenant Fitch. I want those lines prepared for an artillery attack. Artillery, Lieutenant, and rockets, not just mortars. You've got 3 days.
Sir, the troops are right at the edge.
We don't have chainsaws, big shovels, any steel matting. Hell, even sandbags are hard to come by. I mean, with you people and the Arty people using them.
That's right. Preparing for an artillery attack.
Simpson looked out at the valley again through his field glasses.
In Korea, the gooks always hit us with artillery before they attacked.
Don't worry about sandbags, Lieutenant. We've got them on order.
I'm sure you can figure some way to put in the roofs.
Fitch knew he was being dismissed, but he made one last try.
Sir, if I might say, I mean, I know you're right about Arty. We'd be a lot safer with overheads, but... Well, sir, the men in the company get a little spooked if they can't see and hear, and we sort of feel, I mean, even when Captain Black had the company before me, we always chose to maximize the hearing and sight and take the small risk of getting hit by Arty. It's sort of SOP, sir.
Standard operating procedure just changed, Lieutenant. I'm not going to lose good fucking Marines to artillery because of laziness.
Sir?
What?
Sir, they're not lazy. They're tired.
I wasn't talking about the snuffies, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
Now I want to see those fucking fighting holes covered. 3 days, Skipper.
Yes, sir.
Halfway through his second-to-last cigar, Hawk saw Fitch sliding his way down the side of the hill.
How'd it go?
He asked. Fitch told him.
Did you argue with him?
Fitch hesitated, looking down at the ground.
Sure.
Ah, fuck, Jim, not hard enough. Why don't we build the fucking Siegfried line? No, the Pyramid of Cheops. We've got all the slave labor.
Hawk left Fitch squatting alone in the drizzle and stalked off to find Cassidy. Cassidy's hooch was neat and orderly. His rifle and ammunition were hung on carefully whittled pegs stuck into the wooden ammunition crates that formed one wall. Cassidy was gazing at a picture of his wife and 3-year-old son when Hawk stuck his head into the entry. He waved him in, and Hawk filled him in on the bunker problem. Cassidy didn't answer right away. He showed Hawk the picture.
Think he'll be a Marine someday?
Sure, Gunny.
Hawk knew he should say something more, but he couldn't think of anything. There was an awkward silence. Hawk broke it.
So I wondered if maybe you couldn't go see the Sergeant Major? I hear he's been in combat. Maybe he can talk to the Colonel about it.
Cassidy grunted.
I don't want to go looking like no fucking crybaby, Lieutenant, not in front of the Sergeant Major.
But that's what he's for, isn't he? Doesn't he represent the enlisted man's point of view? Cassidy, these kids are fucking tired.
Yeah, but...
Cassidy rolled over on his rubber lady and stared at the poncho, which was ruffling in the damp breeze.
You get the reputation for a crybaby and you're fucking finished.
He looked at Hawk, almost pleading.
If I make E7, we can have another kid, maybe a piano.
Hawk was disappointed in Cassidy.
Okay, Gunny, I see your point. Just thought I'd see what you thought of the idea.
He backed out of the hooch. Cassidy lay there a long time listening to rain spattering against the poncho. He was an acting company gunny in a combat outfit, while only a staff sergeant E6. That meant a lot toward promotion to gunnery sergeant E7. His wife would be proud. His son. But if he complained to the sergeant major... A staff sergeant on the wrong side of the battalion sergeant major would stay a staff sergeant for a very long time.
Fuck!
He finally shouted and crawled out of the hooch. Cassidy found Sergeant Major Knapp supervising the building of the command bunker. Knapp's utilities were clean, his boots shiny and black. He looked like a business executive doing weekend reserve duty. Yet Cassidy knew that, as a teenager, the sergeant major had been at Tarawa. After the usual small talk, Cassidy said he had a problem.
It's about the order to cover the fighting holes with roofs.
I hadn't heard about that.
The colonel told the skipper that we had 3 days to cover the fighting holes with roofs. Wants them sandbagged, leave slits for the rifles and M60s, you know, guns of Navarone.
The sergeant major sat there watching him. Cassidy fidgeted.
Well, goddammit, Sergeant Major, it's a stupid fucking order. You gotta hear and see, and you can't do either in a fucking cave, not with rain beating on the roof. Fucking gooners can crawl right around and hit us blind on our backsides if we can't hear them.
Our men are fucking exhausted. We've been patrolling the shit out of this place, building a fucking LZ, laying goddamn wire, clearing fields of fire, and all we get to work with is our fucking K-bars and E-tools. Our goddamn hands are full of pus.
You're talking about your commanding officer, Staff Sergeant Cassidy, Knapp said quietly. Cassidy swallowed.
Yes, Sergeant Major.
He felt his face burning.
If we get hit, it's going to be by sappers sneaking up on us at night. The gooks won't hit us with artillery. They ain't going to waste ammo that they haul through airstrikes over 400 miles at night on a fucking hill like this.
The Sergeant Major listened impassively. Listening to junior NCOs was part of his job. Cassidy's voice intensified as he saw Knapp's indifference.
They snake up on you, goddammit. You gotta listen for the little bastards. I don't see why these men gotta build their own fucking coffins.
So, what do you want me to do about it? I ain't no fucking crybaby, Sergeant Major, and we got a good fucking company of Marines. We can do what we're told and no griping. But I think the Colonel don't understand the situation, that's all. This ain't fucking Korea. Maybe you could talk to him.
Why doesn't Lieutenant Fitch do that?
I guess he tried.
Then what can I do? Cassidy could see that the Sergeant Major wasn't about to use up chits to help out a young staff sergeant who felt overworked and underpaid. Knapp patted Cassidy on the shoulder. Tell you what, Staff Sergeant Cassidy, I'll see if I can't spare you some men to help after we get done setting up the CP area. I might even be able to secure a chainsaw or two. My God, anything we can do to help, just ask. Cassidy walked wearily down the hill, knowing he had damaged his standing with the Sergeant Major and failed the kids in the company as well. He cursed his temper. By the next morning, a full storm was hurling itself against the hill. The platoon moved in slow motion all day, buffeted by the wind, hampered by cold hands that made grasping E-tools and knives even more difficult than normal. It seemed cruelly unnecessary to Mellis to have to return to the back-breaking work of digging and chopping just when they had reached the point where they could start working on their own living quarters. Yet they dug and chopped, finding the meaning of their actions within the small, prosaic tasks, casting from their minds the larger questions that would only lead them to despair. Vancouver and Conman alternated filling sandbags, one holding a bag open while the other one shoveled in the sticky clay. To Vancouver, each sandbag was just that, nothing more. One filled sandbag to be followed by the next. The small E-tool burned his blisters and sores. He watched the blood and pus from the jungle rot on his fingers and wrists smear in with the mud and rainwater. He paused occasionally to wipe his hands on his trousers, not even thinking that he had to sleep in them. Everything soon had the same greasy consistency anyway, mixing in with the urine that he couldn't quite cut off because he was so cold, the semen from his last wet dream, the cocoa he'd spilled the day before, the snot he rubbed off, the pus from his skin ulcers, the blood from the popped leeches, and the tears he wiped away so nobody would see that he was homesick. Except for his size and the role that he'd taken on, or fallen into, Vancouver was no different from any other teenager in the platoon. He knew that the role gave the others heart, and he had to admit that he liked playing it, because of what it did for his friends and for himself. He liked the respect. Hell, he was almost a celebrity. But he was not ignorant of what it cost. Being on point scared him every time he took it, yet something compelled him to take it every time. Breuer figured he needed 16 of the small logs to complete their bunker. He knelt before the first one, squinting at it through his glasses, not wanting to start. His hand was swollen. He'd cut it on razor grass 2 days earlier, and it had become infected. He'd seen the squid about it, but all Fredrickson could do was paint it with some red shit and give him some Darvon for the pain. When he touched the handle of his K-bar, the pain made him want to pull his hand away and hold it under his armpit, nursing it with the warmth of his body. He hacked at the log with the knife. The pain was intense. The K-bar bounced back from the hardwood, leaving only a small nick. He stared at the nick. He took his left hand and tried again. He was ineffectual left-handed,
The K-bar merely bounced off the wood instead of biting at it.
"Gotta get mad at it,"
Jankowicz said, coming up behind Breuer unexpectedly.
"Like this."
He took the K-bar from Breuer's hand and attacked the log, cursing it. He smashed the large knife against the wood again and again. He screamed filthy language. Small chips began to come out of the wood. Jank suddenly stopped and smiled. He threw the K-bar into the wood, point first, and left it there, quivering.
8 fucking days until I see Susie in Bangkok, he said.
He walked off down the line. When Second Squad returned from patrol, Jacobs immediately noticed how far behind his squad was in building the bunkers. Even though Lieutenant Mellis and Sergeant Bass both had promised him that the squads not on patrol would work equally hard on the entire platoon sector. Hippie's machine gun position did have the beginning of a wall around it, as well as some rather crooked logs, which Jake guessed were rejects from the other squads. He sat down heavily in the mud, legs dangling inside the hole. Hippie took off his wire-rimmed glasses and wiped them on his shirt. He held them up to the rain and looked through them. He put them back on, and then slowly took off his boots, grimacing. He carefully peeled his wet socks from his feet, which were discolored and puffy.
"Those look ugly,"
Jake said. Hippie grunted. He began massaging his feet.
"There it is."
He rubbed a few minutes more, then put his boots back on, wincing, and started taking apart the gun to clean out the dirt and vegetation. Jake wished desperately that Fisher were back, but Fisher was gone. Just like that, taken away, and now here he was, feet dangling in Hippie's machine gun position, everyone tired, the fucking rain beating into the earth, his squad without bunkers, and only 2 days left to complete them.
"No one did shit for us today," Jake said.
He kicked at the side of Hippie's hole, and a glob of mud splashed into the water. He saw Lieutenant Mellis approaching him from Conman's section. Mellis squatted down next to the hole. "Thought I'd save you the trouble of walking uphill to give me the after-action report." Jake noticed that Mellis, too, was dirty and tired, and it made him feel good to think that the lieutenant had been working on the lines as well.
"Nothing, sir. Nothing but rain and fucking jungle."
"No footprints? Nothing?"
"You've been out there. Nothing."
Rain suddenly slashed down on them in heavy sheets. Water ran off Jake's helmet onto his nose and neck in tiny cascades. Jake looked at the lines.
"I see they got a lot done on our bunkers today, sir."
Mellis looked away briefly.
"They did the best they could. As far as they were concerned, you guys got to screw off with a walk in the park."
Hippie slammed home the bolt of the machine gun, startling both Jake and Mellis.
"Tell me something, Lieutenant," Hippie said. "Just tell me where the gold is."
"Gold?"
Mellis looked puzzled, but Jake knew that Hippie was struggling with something deep. He could see Hippie's jaw muscles trying to control the frustration and exhaustion.
"Yes, the gold, the fucking gold, or the oil, or uranium, something. Jesus Christ, something out there for us to be here. Just anything. Then he'd understand it. Just some fucking gold so it all made sense."
Mellis didn't answer. He stared at the jungle for a long time.
"I don't know," he finally said.
"I wish I did."
"There it is,"
Jake said. He lifted the butt of his rifle to the earth beside him and pushed himself to his feet. Mellis stood with him.
"Look, Jake, I know it's tough, but we've got some daylight left. Get some food and see if you can't fill some sandbags for foundations for the roofs before dark."
Jake looked at Mellis dully, trying to comprehend it all. He turned without saying a word to pass the order down to the fire team leaders. The light began to fade and the lines grew quiet as the company went on the evening stand-to. Williams and Cortell, who had been working next to Johnson on their own bunker, were cleaning their M-16s in what light remained. These two had been together ever since they came in country. Cortell, the leader of Jankowicz's second fire team, was small and, had he been better fed, would have been round. His slightly receding hairline made him look older than his 19 years. Williams, tall and rangy, with the big hands of a rancher, was almost Cortell's physical opposite. What they had in common, besides the Marine